Congratulations, boy.
Many gave their lives that we might stand here once again, united in the government of a lawful republic.
Gaius Octavian was henceforth to be regarded, for all intents and purposes, as my lawful son.
Gaius Octavian.
Welcome back, everybody, except the fundamentalist Christians who get offended easily. Yeah, no. I'm surprised, Ray, that we have any of those left, quite frankly. One of our listeners emailed us yesterday to say he was unsubscribing from Alexander and Caesar. Because I upset him on an Alexander show recently when I said, look, it's a long story, but Ray and I were talking about whales and you had to be there and how they were land mammals. Their ancestors were land mammals who entered this ocean again 48 million years ago. And Ray said, but hold on, the Bible tells me the Earth's only 6,000 years old. And I said, well, anyone who believes that is a moron. Well, apparently I offended at least one person who does believe the Earth is only 5,000 to 6,000 years old. One of our listeners who is a young Earth creationist and then sent us a long email trying to say that evolution and geology and these things are just theories. They haven't been proven. And I was like, wow, you've just proven my point.
Yeah. Well, here's my thing. The one thing I would possibly concede on his string of emails was, okay, big bang, who lit the spark? I mean, we don't know because we weren't there. I mean, how many times has this happened? You know, the universe expands, it contracts, whatever. But the point is, I mean, yeah, you don't have any proof, so you can't be offended by something that you think that may quite possibly be wrong.
Well, you can you be, just gotta, but
you can be, obviously.
Yeah, you shouldn't be listening to this show if you're easily offended, folks. Anyway.
Raise the bar. Yeah. Anyway,
this episode of The Life of Augustus,
yes,
is brought to you by Hillsdale College with their new Winston Churchill series, hillsdale.edu/LOC. Don't forget the LOC.
It's important.
Which stands for lick our
others.
Lick our chops.
No.
LOC, hillsdale.edu/LOC. I also want to give another plug for the Vegas video while we have your attention. Lifeofcaesar.com/Vegas. Did a big discount on that and also on our Alexander series, short-term discounts, just to test pricing levels, to be honest with you, over the week on Facebook. So if you're not on our Facebook page, then you're missing out. It's time, just before we get into this, we did announce this on the Alexander series last week. But for those of you who don't subscribe to that, should we even tell those people? Because seriously, like, do they even deserve to know? Yeah.
Well, yes, there's a lot of freeloaders on this show, but there's some that you know, help us, support us each month. So let's just whisper it into their microphones and their earbuds and not tell the other ones.
Right. How's that? Everyone who's not a patron of this show or doesn't subscribe to the Alexander Show, stop listening now because this isn't for you. Go and read your Young Earth Creationist Bible for a few minutes while we tell everybody else. So Ray and I have decided, and the emails that we got. Look, we're starting a new series at the end of March.
Yes.
It's not replacing anything. It's a third
addition.
Yeah.
It's an addition.
Addition. Now, I know young earth creationists probably don't believe in math, but for the rest of you, math is just a theory. You can't prove that 2 + 2 = 4. Nope. Who created the plus in the first place, huh?
God.
Notice how a plus looks like a cross, huh? Did you, huh? You think that's a coincidence?
That's
bananas, man.
No.
We're starting a third series, so we'll have Caesar, we'll have Alexander. Even though Alexander's, you know, it's getting towards the end, but we still got, I think, 6 months. We do get Wars of the Diadoke and all that kind of stuff.
Someone's got to clean up his mess.
Or make a bigger mess out of his mess.
Exactly.
We're going to start a third series at the end of March, and it is going to be the history of the Cold War.
Cold War. I was just trying to echo your voice.
Okay. It's very, well, I'm super excited. But are you excited, Ray?
I started reading one of the, I went to the library and got a whole bunch of books. They looked at me like I was crazy. But I'd forgotten how much I enjoy this subject very much, obviously, at the end of World War II. I am so stoked about this. We're going to go down so many rabbit holes. It's going to be insane. I just cannot wait to get this started.
Yeah, me either. It's I've been reading up a storm and very exciting. I mean, obviously, it's going to cover, you know, the atomic race. It's going to cover the Korean War, right. Vietnam, Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, the spread of communism through places like China, mm-hmm. as well as the USSR. Right. It's going to cover.
We are going to get into it all.
And of course, you know, me being me, I'm going to try and bring a different perspective to the one that you've probably heard. I can pretty much guarantee that if you know anything about the Cold War, you have a very pro-Western perspective of it. America's the good guys, Russia's the bad guys, end of story. And as with all things in history that we've covered so far, usually when you drill down into it, doesn't break down as easy as good guys and bad guys. Nothing is that binary. Yeah.
Exactly.
So I'm going to try and come up with a lot of good stuff to show both sides. Ray will just giggle. Right. That's right.
I'm going to be pro fucking Western. I'm going to be wearing a cowboy hat while we're recording this show.
Yeah.
And boots and no pants. I can't wait to get started.
So that'll be starting the end of March is the current plan. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's get on with Augie.
Yes. Augie.
Where are we? We're about, I still think we're about 40, 41, 40.
40 or mid 40 BC.
So at the end of the last episode, I think we had the Peruzine War between Octavian and Lucius Antonius and Fulvia, Mark Antony's wife. Octavian wins, makes peace with Lucius, Fulvia, and Antony's mother, Julia, jump on a boat, get the hell out of Italy.
Yes. I want to say that was staged. I think everybody knew that Caesar had enough sense not to kill or to hurt the wife, mother, or brother of Marcus Antonius. I think it was staged. I think it was trying to, you know, drama pageantry there, trying to drum up some sympathy. But I think even though they fled away, I don't think they had to, but they certainly got back to Mark Antony safe. But I think it was all just a big put on.
Yeah. Well, leaving that aside for a second, we want to start this episode with a poem.
Oh, I like poems.
Oh, this is such a sweet poem as well. Okay. This is a poem that allegedly Octavian himself wrote around about the time of the Battle of Perusia.
Can I ask that we may dare yet have our first Augustus coffee mug? Saying?
I definitely think we need this needs a coffee mug. And it goes like this. Antony screws Glaphyra, so Fulvia as revenge wants to nail me. What, should I screw Fulvia? What then if Menias pleads with me to bugger him? Should I? I don't think so, if I've an ounce of sense. Either shag or fight, she says. Well, my prick is dearer to me than my very life. Let battle commence. Now,
I'm going to fit that onto a mug.
It does not rhyme. I don't know what meter this has as a poem. But now, this was quoted by the late 1st century CE Roman poet Marcus Valerius Martialis, mm-hmm. known in English usually as Martial.
Right.
Best known for his 12 books of epigrams published in Rome between AD, God damn it, C. I hate when people write AD in my notes, between 86 and 103 CE during the reigns of Domitian, Nerva, and Trajan. Now, he quoted Octavian's poem, apparently, because he was getting some shit thrown at him for writing dirty little poems. And he said, hey, it was good enough for the Emperor Augustus to talk about screwing and buggering and his penis. Then I think that's a precedent. I think I should be allowed to. Now, I drilled down into Marshall because I didn't know a lot about him. He apparently wrote short, witty poems that satirized city life and the scandalous activities of his acquaintances, which were epigrams. And that's actually where we get the word epigram from, is from his 12 books of epigrams. He's the creator of the modern epigram. He wrote a total of 1,561 epigrams.
Wow.
Now, would you like to hear some of his epigrams, Ray?
Yes, please.
I thought you would. Here's one I liked. Fabulous's wife, Bassa, frequently totes a friend's baby, on which she loudly dotes. Why does she take this childcare duty? It explains her farts that are somewhat fruity.
Sorry.
That's why I carry Fox around with me everywhere. if you don't have a dog, get a baby. And this one. Rumor tells, Kiona, that you are a virgin and that nothing is purer than your fleshy delights. Nevertheless, you do not bathe with the correct part covered. If you have the decency, move your panties onto your face.
What the hell?
And this one. I felt a little ill and called Dr. Symmachus. Well, you came, Symmachus, but you brought 100 medical students with you. 100 ice-cold hands poked and jabbed me. I didn't have a fever, Symmachus, when I called you, but now I do. apart from the criticism and the humor, he also had some wisdom. I like this one. Some wisdom about procrastination. Because I know this applies to many of our listeners who are going through their lives going, you know, one day I'm going to record a podcast, but I'll do it tomorrow, or next week. Here's what Marshall has to say to you. Tomorrow you will live, you always cry. In what fair country does this morrow lie, that 'tis so mighty long ere it arrive? Beyond the Indies does this morrow live? 'Tis so far-fetched, this morrow, that I fear 'twill both be very old and very dear. Tomorrow I will live, the fool does say. Today itself's too late. The wise lived yesterday.
Ah.
Don't procrastinate, I think is what he's saying. More dirty ones. We'll get into it. Doors open wide, unguardened. Unguardened shit. Let me drink coffee. Hold on.
Okay. If I could sum up that poem, which Rocky movie was it? The character said to Rocky, there is no tomorrow. So, boom, you know, three words. But anyway, but the other one was...
Adrian!
Rock!
He said
there is no tomorrow, Rock!
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
I will crush you. No, it probably wasn't Drago. Doors open wide, unguarded, when you sin, lesbia. You don't conceal your tricks. You like a watcher better than a lover. You're not thankful for obscure delights. Whores, conversely, don't want witnesses. Curtains, bolts, no cracks reveal the brothels. At least you might learn modesty from them. The foulest find a place behind the tombs. Do you really think that what I say is too harsh? I don't say don't fuck, lesbia. Just don't be seen.
Deep, deep wisdom.
And the last one. Carinus. He's quite well, Carinus. Still, he's pale. Hardly drinks, Carinus. Still he's pale. A fine digestion too, Carinus. Still he's pale. He takes the sun, Carinus. Still he's pale. He dyes his skin, Carinus. Still he's pale. Eats pussy yet, Carinus. Still he's pale. Don't really know how to explain that, but I don't know.
There you are.
So back to Octavian's poem. He says that Antony is fucking Glaphyra. Do you know who Glaphyra was, Ray? Did you research that?
I did. I was mostly because I was hoping to see a picture of her. She sounded pretty hot. She was the, I guess, current lover of the governor or the king or whatever it was of Cappadocia. And she was trying to use her feminine ways to get Marcus Antonius to make her son the leader, ruler, or representative of that place. He did end up picking someone else, so I guess it didn't work at first. But eventually, I don't know if that person died or what happened, but eventually her son does come into power into Cappadocia, obviously representing Marcus Antonius. So her lovemaking ways were not for nothing. So good for her.
So I thought he was banging Cleopatra.
She was a warm-up. Glaphyra was the warm-up.
The warm-up for
because
Cleopatra.
He spent the winter of 41 in Greece, and then we're gonna meet her later. So, yeah, she was the warm-up.
Well, I have a little bit more detail on her. Glaphyra was what was known as a hetaira, a form of courtesan in ancient Greece, like a prostitute. You had the hetaira, which were the high-class prostitutes, basically. They were like geisha girls.
Yeah.
They had studied in all of the sexual arts, but they were also like companions. If anyone's ever watched Firefly or Serenity, they're like the companion. Mm-hmm. Whatever that actress's name is.
So she can talk to you and... Screw your brains out. She can talk to you about whatever, poetry and whatever, and then screw your brains
out. Yeah, apparently ancient Greece had two classes, at least, of prostitute. You had the pornoi, who provided sex for a large number of clients in brothels or on the street. And then you had the heteroi, who were thought to only have a few men or even one man as clients at any one time. They would have long-term relationships with them. They'd go to the theater, they'd go out to dinner parties and provide intellectual stimulation as well as sex. Like, you are my heteroi, Ray.
Well, thank you. I think.
Now, she had been married to Archelaus, the high priest ruler of Cappadocia, which is in modern Turkey. But he died. But by the way, his father, Archelaus' father of the same name, was a descendant of our old friend King Mithridates VI of Pontus.
Mithridates the Great.
Yeah. So why was she banging Antony? Well, back in 47, so about six or so years previously, Big Julie had deposed Archelaus of his office of high priest because he had supported Pompey in the civil war. And he did that because Pompey had appointed his father, Archelaus, also, as the high priest ruler. Now, that's interesting because we know from our last series, the Caesar series, that Pompey was the guy that, you know, hunted down and killed Mithridates the sixth, right. You know, was the last Roman to, you know, fight him.
So,
But, you know, as we've seen time and time again, you're my enemy this week, you're my friend tomorrow. I think Archelaus may have done the dirty on Mithridates from memory. He may have gone over to Pompey when he saw the writing on the wall. Anyway.
Right.
Pompey had appointed him high priest ruler. Anyway, so Archelaus II had died at some unknown date. Glaphyra remained in Cappadocia with her sons. And then, she saw an opportunity. Let's, you know, bang Mark Antony and get him to reinstall my son, which he did, as you said. But, you know, in 36... That's a lot earlier than, where are we up to? Oh no, we're 40. Okay, we're 40. Yeah, so a few years later, 36, he does that.
Yeah.
Alrighty then. So yeah, it seems that gossip and rumor about Antony's affair with Glaphyra had reached Rome before he started tickling Cleopatra's back door. So this and according to Octavian, if the poem is legitimate, it was Antony's affair with Glaphyra that upset Fulvia enough to start another civil war in Rome with Lucius.
I just think it's interesting that that's the way she chose to lash out. But be that as it may, I mean, I'm still trying to figure that one out. But even though we don't know a lot about her, obviously, from what we do know about Fulvia, she was a very powerful woman, a very strong-willed woman. She certainly didn't want to be hemmed in like all the other women. She wanted to break the bounds, if you will, and she was certainly doing a very good job of it up until the moment her and her her brother-in-law lost to Caesar. So she was certainly I don't know if you want to call it acting out or just trying to get everything she could. When a woman is pissed, there are no bounds. Trust me, I piss them off all the time. So who knows? But
shout out to Jessica.
I just think she had nothing to lose at that point. I'm sorry, shout out to
Jessica.
But
here's the thing that I don't understand. Like, we know that it was fairly common and accepted in ancient Rome for men to have mistresses and prostitutes and the whole deal. That wasn't really something that was frowned upon. Wives didn't expect monogamy. Most marriages weren't for love. They were for political or practical reasons. Right. And, you know, we know that she'd been married several times before. So I don't understand really why she would be so upset. And we know Antony's history. He's had mistresses and courtesans by the camel load, man, you know. So why all of a sudden is Fulvia getting pissy over this? Is it because the women that he is having these affairs with, her and Cleopatra, Glaphyra and Cleopatra, aren't your typical... They're not the wife of some minor senator. Right. She's not a...
Or prostitute.
Yeah, common prostitute.
Common prostitute, exactly. Yeah,
they're sort of, you know, queens or consorts to kings. And maybe they were just... Something about them really threatened her, if this is a true story anyway, and not just dirty, dirty myths.
Right. I don't know. I just can't help but think that she's thinking, yes, I know you're going to do this, Marcus Antonius. You've been doing this ever since you reached puberty. But does everybody have to know about it? Do you have to flaunt it? Or does it have to become common knowledge and to some degree embarrass me or whatever? But I don't think she was your average wife or average woman. I think she was above average intelligent and ambition and cruelty. And she just wasn't going to sit still for that. I just don't really understand why she reacted the way she did, but I guess we'll never know because she's
a woman
dead now.
Because she's a woman. Who understands how women think? No. Really? Seriously?
No.
Who understands it? I don't. I just nod and smile and go, of course, dear.
There you go.
Yes, dear.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, and last thing about this poem that Octavian wrote, pretty crude, even by the standards of the time, apparently, but it tells us a lot about Octavian's level of self-confidence at this stage that he can write a filthy poem about Antony and his wife and Menias.
Well, I mean, because I'm trying to remember, he was born in 63. So what is he, like 23, 24 years old? In just a matter of couple, I mean, I'm just trying to explain that, the flesh out that statement that, yes, he is very confident to write something like that. Here he is. He's 24 years old. He's one of the two most powerful men in their known world. I mean, he's come very far, very fast. And I don't know, we know he was ambitious. There was a certain amount of skill for his age, but there's a point that you keep bringing up, and I think it has a lot of legitimacy. Is he acting alone? Is there a team behind him? And at the end of the day, and this just reminds me of Napoleon, he was very lucky. He had so many things go his way. I mean, first of all, his adopted father, Caesar, you know, is murdered. So what kind of life would Octavian would have had if his adopted father had not been killed? I mean, he might have had to wait around for a decade or two to get any kind of serious office. We don't know. Cicero attacks Mark Antony when they're fighting in the Senate, which weakens Mark Antony. Cicero sides with him, but when the Senate kicks him out, Octavius, he joins Marcus Antonius and Lepidus, and they did not have to accept him, so he got lucky there. And then when he is attacking Marcus Antonius's brother Lucius, he is not himself attacked by Marcus Antonius's generals, who are nearby. They're merely just a few miles away. So just the string of amazing occurrences that he's able to turn his way, or even without him trying to do something, situations just seem to break his way. But he certainly is skillfully applying himself to all these totally unexpected or earth-shattering events, and he's come very far in just a matter of years. So why not be cocky and write that kind of poem when you feel like you can't be touched anymore?
I wouldn't say that all of those things you mentioned were luck, though. I mean, no. He played the game relatively well. He had his hiccups, but, you know, Antony and Lepidus, didn't have to do a deal with him, but
right.
It was.
But they needed him at that moment. Mm. They didn't need him at other times, but they need. So, but you're right. He had bad luck. He had his first march on Rome, and the crowds weren't too happy to see him. The first battle of Philippi, when he can't even participate because he's sick. As far as we know, he has those two sicknesses where maybe he was close to death. Who knows? His mutinous soldiers, like you were talking about last episode. He literally sent an envoy to the soldiers to calm down. They kill this soldier, the centurion, and put him in the path that Octavius has to go across so he can see the body. I mean, he's definitely had his bad luck, but he has literally defied the odds so many times that obviously he is the son of a god who is looking out for him and helping him from on high. There's no other way to explain it.
Yeah, and the Earth is only 6,000 years old. It all makes
and flat.
It all makes sense. Now, luck again plays a part in Octavian's story. Calenus, who we mentioned towards the end of the last episode, he's one of Antony's guys. He's controlling Cisalpine Gaul, which is now officially part of Italy. Cisalpine Gaul is basically northern Italy and sort of the Monaco and the bits of France that connect up to that.
Right. That you have to walk to get to Spain. Yeah,
basically, once you get over the Alps, everything between there and Italy. He dies just of an illness, nothing suspicious as far as we know. Nope. And his son takes over the 11 legions that he has in this area.
I got it, Dad!
And the son's name is Fufius. Fufikins. Fufi! Here, boy.
He's not going far. He's not going far with that name. No. Quintus Fufius Calenus.
So, not going. Somebody brings Octavian the news. He goes, hey, Octavian, big news. Calenus up in Cisalpine Gaul is dead and his son's taken over. And Octavian's like, really? What's his son's name? They go, Fufius. He goes, oh, my God. I'm on my way. Let me.
Road trip.
I can take a Fufi. Like, there's not many people I can be confident in taking mano a mano, but Fufikins, named Fufikins, I'm going to make my bitch. Now, Octavian, they reckon, was only probably marginally older than Fufikins, if anything.
Which is saying something.
Yeah. But basically, he rushes up to Cisalpine Gaul, has an audience with Fufikins and goes, listen, Fufikins, seriously? Fufikins, that's what your dad called you? Like, holy shit. Let's just be honest. You and me, like mano a mano, Fufikins. These 11 legions aren't gonna take commands for anyone called Fufikins. Right, you get that, right? You understand it? He's like, yeah, I guess.
Yes.
All right, well, how about you give them to me? Like, my name is Caesar. Julius Caesar, motherfucker. Like, come on. He goes, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, okay. Here's my 11 legions. Yeah. So he now has 11 more legions, and he sends his old buddy, Salvidinius Rufus, to take control of those legions because he and Rufus are going to be lifelong buddies forever.
Oh yeah,
forever. Nothing can bring them apart. Yeah. Him, yeah. Rufus, and Agrippa. They were all in Apollonia together when they got the news. He's BFFF. Rufus has been with him since that very moment, all along the way. Nothing will ever tear them apart. This is what Rufus used to sing to Octavian. Don't ask me what you know is true. Don't have to tell you I love your precious heart, Octavian. I was standing in Apollonia. You were there when we heard that Caesar died. Two worlds collided, and they could never tear us apart. Two, three. We could live for a thousand years, but if I hurt you, I'll make wine from your tears. I told you that we could fly, because we all have wings, but some of us don't know why. I was standing, you were there, two worlds colliding. Yeah, Michael Hutchence.
Suffice it to say, Caesar and Rufus are going to grow old together. They're going to have so many stories to swap. In fact, they probably got matching necklaces with a half of a heart, wearing them all the time. It's going to be lovely.
Unlike Michael Hutchence. Do you know how Michael Hutchence died?
No.
The lead singer of NXS? Did you know that was NXS, by the way? Do you know that song?
Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah, I do know NXS.
Michael Hutchence was found dead in a hotel room with a belt around his neck tied to the hotel doorknob.
Jesus.
What do they call that?
Yeah.
Something, asphyxiation, self something.
Yeah.
Jerking off, basically, is the assumption. With a belt around his neck to increase the strength of the orgasm. Kids, if you're listening to this,
don't do that.
Kids, don't do that. Don't tie anything around your neck when you're jerking off.
The old-fashioned way will suffice. Trust me.
Yeah, just put something under your armpit to numb your hand so it feels like it's somebody else, and well, the old Derek and Clive thing. Get a train set. And put a toilet roll, attach it to the top of the train, lube it up, stick your old fella in that. And whenever it goes over the bridge, you never listened to Derek and Clive when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Oh. Must have just been me. While he's away, Octavian, yes.
Not the train.
Uh-huh. While he's up in Cisalpine Gaul, bitch slap and foofy. Antony arrives back in Italy, but there's a slight problem, isn't there, Ray?
There is, but the bitch arrives in style. He is coming with a massive fleet, and I've got some additional notes on this when we come later, but basically he spent some time he wintered in Athens in 41, why wouldn't you? Eventually, and we're going to get into all this later, he demands that Cleopatra comes to see him in Tarsus. We're going to get into all that. He's going to go there, spend some time with her, getting to know her, getting to know the lay of the land up to the point where she ends up preggers. But anyway, so he's coming back. He doesn't know what to believe. His wife has told him horrible stories. He's heard things. Is his brother Lucius still alive? He's got to figure out what's going on. Now, the problem is when Marcus Antonius comes back, he has allowed Cneius Domitius Ahenobarbus, who was one of the admirals for Cassius and Brutus, he allows him to join him and bring all his ships. So when Marcus Antonius comes back, he's bringing Ahenobarbus with him. But unfortunately, Ahenobarbus has been raiding the coast up until this point on his own, not because Mark Antony, this is before then. He's been raiding the coast because, you know, Cassius and Brutus are dead. What is he going to do? All he has is a fleet. He's got to do something. So he's been raiding the coast. So when Marcus Antonius shows up to Brundisium, they close the port city to him because they're not focused on him. They're focused on Ahenobarbus and all his ships. But Marcus Antonius, and you really can't blame him for this, misconstrues this as far as I can tell and thinks that it's Caesar telling them to close off the port city to him because he has indeed declared war against his previous partner. But when Caesar hears about this, you know, he's way up there in Cisalpine Gaul. He's going to come flying back. And he's going to, not only does he have the new 11 legions that he has, not only does he have the other legions that he has, as he's coming back, he starts to raise even more troops. We are talking about tens of thousands of additional men because they're pretty much happy with the land they're getting from Caesar. So all that hard work he was doing has been paying off. The men, at least, like him. Because you got to remember this, the triumvirs were never popular, they were never loved, they were hated and feared. So, but the soldiers, young men like him, so when he says, I need some more men, they all say yes. So he's got even more legions now, and he comes all the way down, and he comes to Brundisium, and suddenly there's this impasse. What's going to happen? You know, he's sitting on the land, Mark Antony's sitting on the ocean, they don't trust each other, but here's the key, neither one of them know what the other one's thinking or what the other one wants to happen. So there's this, they're just sitting there staring at each other. Is it going to be war? What the hell is going on? Someone's got to do something.
So, yeah, back to Ahenobarbus, and he's the son of old Redbeard that we talked about back in the old JC days.
Arr.
He was also charged, or had been charged, as one of Caesar's assassins, even though he wasn't there and didn't stick the knife in, or maybe was there and didn't stick the knife in. He was certainly supportive of the assassination, and so he was one of the, you know, classified as one of Caesar's assassins, also one of the proscribed, because of that, if no other reason. Right. And now Antony's done a fucking deal with him, and he's buddies with him. Like, Antony's entire existence, his whole purpose, his whole justification for everything that he's done since Caesar was assassinated three or four years ago. Got to revenge Caesar, and now he's like, but unless the guy's got a fleet. I mean, okay, like, I want to avenge Caesar, but he's got ships. So he just...
A lot of ships.
Goes, you know, like I said before, everyone can be your enemy until really they're not anymore, and then they're your friend. It doesn't, you know. The Romans are nothing if not practical.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now... As you say, Octavian has got, I think, something like 40 legions. Now, if they're at full strength, the legion's about 4,500. 4 is that, and carry the 6 and take that one around, stick it up behind.
Yeah.
180 million people. No, that's not right. Right. 180,000. Troops.
So I'm guessing they're not at full strength, but the point is he commands the land. No one can touch him when it comes to land troops. So what he says goes.
And so he's got them all and they're marching to Brundisium. He goes, hey, you want to go fight? Oh, yeah, we want to fight. Yeah.
Kicks them.
And they're sort of halfway to Brundisium. And somebody goes, maybe we should have asked this before, Octavian. A.K.A. Julius Caesar the second, old son, but slipped my mind at the time, got really excited. Who are we fighting? He goes, hi, Antony. Which, Lucius? No, Marcus Antonius. Yeah. We're fighting Mark the Antony. The hero of the Battle of Philippi. Yeah.
We're going to crush him.
And they went, fuck!
We're gonna die.
And they didn't even stop. They didn't even miss a beat. They're just walking, and then they just spin.
Pivot, turn, boom.
Yeah, like a Nazi soldier on parade. They just spin on one foot and start marching back home. Yeah, didn't miss a beat.
And start muttering under the son of
a bitch. I'm nearly Why done. Didn't we fuck it? Yeah. We got to learn to ask that question at the before we march for 3 days.
Ask first, cheer second. No, so he still had a decent number with him, but yes, some of them certainly turned around, and the ones who did stay were not nearly as enthusiastic because they know it's coming. But as much as he's weakened, as much as his forces were reduced, Mark Antony's got his own problems on the other side. So they're literally coming at each other, total mistrust, but also a lack of knowledge of the other's intent. And they also, for various reasons, are coming weaker than they were before. And so they're just going to kind of stare at each other. But I find this so interesting. So here they are. Okay, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? You know, they've got options. So Marcus Antonius is looking at this young kid who's 24 years old, who's come out of nowhere, and now is his quote unquote equal. He's like, okay, he's got more land troops than I do. I've got all these ships. Look at all these fucking ships. They won't do me any good on land. I've got sailors. I don't have soldiers. He is the one who's in charge of the land right now. And we're going to get into this later, so I'm not going to dig too much into it. Before all this, Caesar had recently gotten married to someone who was related to Sextus Pompeius. So now he's got a semi-connection to Sextus. So it's like, is Caesar and Sextus going to gang up against me? Because Sextus has got a fleet. So if you put Caesar's troops and Sextus's ships against me, I'm fucking doomed. So here I am. I've got to go back to the east. It's a complete clusterfuck, and we're going to get into all this later, but the Parthians are running all over the place. I got to go back there. In fact, because of the Parthians, I could use all my ships and bring back a whole bunch of men, but there hardly are any men because we've been raiding this place for years, and I have to leave a lot of warriors there to take on the Parthians, so I can't ship a lot of guys over. I'm in a bad situation, and let's just pull back for a second. Do I need to kill this young Caesar? What do I get out of it? If I fight and I win, I have to stay here and control the western part of this empire. The people hate us. They don't trust us. If they get a chance to kill us, they will. So this is a powder keg ready to explode. Someone's got to watch it, but I've got to go back to the east. I've knocked up the queen of Egypt. I got Parthians all over the place. I don't know who I can trust over there. They still owe me a shit ton of taxes. I got to go back and collect. So why in the hell should I fight if I don't need to fight? So let's kind of find out what, this is what I'm thinking. What is Caesar thinking?
Well, Caesar's thinking, let's get Lucius to act as a mediator between his brother and I.
Sounds better than fighting.
Yeah. Appian writes, then he summoned Lucius to his presence and praised him for his attachment to his brother because he had taken the blame upon himself while carrying out Antony's wishes, but reproached him with ingratitude if, after meeting such a favor from himself, he should now refuse to make confession regarding Antony, who was said to have formed an alliance openly with Pompeius.
Right.
Having confidence in you, he said, when Calenus died, I took charge of his provinces and army through my friends for Antony. It was for Antony. It wasn't for me.
Yeah.
It was for Antony. Oh. So that they might not be without a head. Because, you know, Foofy, really, couldn't leave it up to Foofy.
Yeah.
But now that
he's not ahead.
But now that the plot is unveiled, I shall keep them all for myself. And if you wish to go to your brother, I will allow you to do so fearlessly. He spoke thus either to test Lucius or in order that what he said might reach Antony. Lucius replied in the same spirit as before, saying, I knew that Fulvia was in favor of the monarchy, but I joined with her and made use of my brother's soldiers to overthrow all of you. And now, if my brother should come to dissolve the monarchy, by which he's talking about the triumvirate, I will go to join him, either openly or secretly, and will fight you again in behalf of the country, although you have been a benefactor to me. But if he seeks allies to assist him in maintaining the tyranny, I will fight on your side against him as long as I think that you, too, are not trying to establish a monarchy. For I shall always set my country above gratitude and above family. Mm. So spake Lucius. Octavian, holding him in the same admiration as recently at Perugia, said that he did not wish to incite him against his brother, but that he would entrust to Lucius, because he was what he was, the whole of Spain and the army in it, with Perdiccas and Lucius, who now commanded it, as his lieutenants. Thus Octavian dismissed Lucius with honour, but kept a secret watch upon him by means of his lieutenants. Now, this Lucius is one Samuel L. Jackson badass motherfucker, I've got to say. He's like, listen, I might go.
He's trying to die.
I might go and fight you.
That's right.
Yeah. But tell you what, this whole conversation reminds me of. It reminds me of that great scene in Heat.
You know, we're sitting here. You and I are like a couple of regular fellas. I mean, you do what you do, I do what I gotta do. And now that we've been face to face, if I'm there and I gotta put you away, I won't like it. But I'll tell you, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're gonna turn into a widow, brother, you are going down.
There's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in and I gotta put you down? Because no matter what, you will not get my way. We've been face to face, yeah. But I will not hesitate, not for a second.
Maybe that's the way it'll be. Or, who knows?
Or maybe we'll never see each other again.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Love.
Look, I will fuck you up. I will fuck you up for country. I will fuck my brother for country. Whatever. I'm all about the country because I'm going down in the history books as the country fucking mother lover. I don't know, whatever. But I think it's bullshit. I think it's just his stance or whatever, but at least he's got the balls to say it to the man who has him in his possession. You got to give him credit for that.
You love fucking country, is that right, Ray?
Yes.
Well, that's good to know. I feel a little bit cheated, but okay. I always knew that that would come. It would always happen one day.
Yeah.
Speaking of dealing cards.
Yeah.
Hillsdale College, Ray.
Yes.
They're dealing some kick-ass free Winston Churchill cards. I don't know if you've seen those,
cool,
but they're awesome. Winston Churchill, in all of the prep that I've been doing for the Cold War show, obviously Churchill, yeah, key component of,
right,
the creation of the Cold War. I went and listened. There's a YouTube of his Iron Curtain speech. There is an, ooh, Iron Curtain being thrown up in Eastern Europe and everything behind, yep, it, blah, 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 blah. anyway, he and Stalin were quite buddy-buddy for a while there, but then he turned around and, you know, as Stalin saw it, fucked him up the ass. But you can learn everything you ever wanted to know and more about Winston Churchill's statesmanship and leadership by getting this new free online course from our friends at Hillsdale College. Just go to hillsdale.edu/LOC, sign up today. If you sign up with LOC, it's completely free.
Yes.
And do it now, please. Please, we're begging. Please do it now.
Yes. Can't stress enough the free part. It's a 6-week course. Go check it out. And they got some other stuff as well. But just check that out and get the, you know, it's there. It's free. It's written. It, part of it is used. They use the Churchill biographer Martin Gilbert's work.
Oh, Gilbert's. I love Martin Gilbert's.
So check that out. And again, it is free, people. Go check it out.
Unlike our Cold War series, which won't be.
Which will not. It shan't. It shan't be free.
Shall not. Anyway,
no.
Back to what's going on here.
Yeah.
So who's in the stronger position here? Antony's got a massive fleet, some troops. Don't forget, Sexy P had offered him an alliance in the last episode. But
that just gets him more ships.
More ships.
Yeah. What am I going to do with more ships? Yeah.
Well, they can blockade Italy and, you know, starve them out, I guess. It's sort of the naval version of circumvallation. But
right.
But then Octavian's got, as we said, like 150 to 200,000 troops, depending on what strength.
Shit ton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Antony now calls in the offer from Sexy P. Remember, he said to him, look, if Octavian, you know, does what he says he's going to do, I'm sorry, you know, I got to stick with that. You got to dance to the one who brung you. Dance with the one who brung you. But if he tries to fuck me, then I'll call you in. So he calls in Sexy P. Appian writes, the citizens close their gates against Ahenobarbus as an old enemy and against Antony as one introducing an enemy. Antony was indignant and considering this a pretense and that he was in fact shut out by Octavian's garrison at the latter's insistence, he drew a ditch and palisade across the isthmus that connects the town with the mainland. So there's, the port of Brundisium is out on a little thing sticking out in the water. What do you call that?
Right. Peninsula?
Yeah, that's it. Peninsula. Antony, with the troops that he has, gets in behind it and blocks off their connection to the mainland. Oh, here's the next fucking sentence. The city is situated on a peninsula.
I got your back. I'm right behind you. Don't worry about it. All the time I'm right.
Are you Appian? Did you ride Appian? Maybe. Which fronts a crescent-shaped harbour, and the people coming from the mainland could no longer reach the rising ground on which the city stands, as it had been cut off and walled in. Antony also surrounded the harbour, which is large, and the islands in it with towers planted closely together. He sent forces along the coasts of Italy, whom he ordered to seize the advantageous positions. He called upon Pompeius also to move against Italy with his fleet and do whatever he could. Pompeius, with alacrity, dispatched Menedorus with a numerous fleet and four legions of soldiers who seized Sardinia, which belonged to Octavian, and two legions in it who were panic-stricken at this agreement between Pompeius and Antony. In Italy, Antony's men captured the town of Sepuntum of Ausonia. Pompeius besieged Thurii and Consentia and ravaged their territory with his cavalry. So it's on like Donkey Kong.
Right.
But
and then it's not.
And then but before that I want to drill down on this Parthia throwaway line that you said before, that the Parthians had invaded Syria. And who was leading the Parthian armies?
Oh, pick me. Pick me. Oh, you did.
The,
okay.
The bald fellow, the short bald guy in the front.
None other than Titus Labienus, wait for it, Junior. Except for when I looked him up on a different thing, he had a different name. So his name was either Titus Labienus whatever or Quintus Labienus Parthicus, because he joins up with the Parthians.
Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting. So I don't know how much you want to go into, but when Marcus Antonius was doing things he desired to do to Cleopatra, who desired to have them done to her, the Parthians decided to take this opportunity and to reclaim a lot of the Western Asia Minor and to go after as much territory as they could, knowing that everything was in the state of flux. So, you got Titus Labienus and another Roman who are leading some troops, and they go down there with some Parthian troops, and they go into Syria, and they're having trouble. But then Titus Labienus is able to talk to the Romans that he had just fought, and he got them to switch sides. And so now that they have some more Roman troops, if you will, on their side, they split into two forces. One of them heads south and goes into Judea, and one of them with Titus Labienus goes to the north and takes on a man of Marcus Antonius's and is able to kill him and capture some territory. So this whole thing is getting just totally out of control in Asia Minor, in the East, that is now Marcus Antonius's responsibility. So the Parthians are just running all over the place, and they're able to capture so much territory. I'm trying to remember the extent that they were able to grab everything that they had during the Achaemenid dynasty. So they have grabbed a lot of territory while the Romans are truly falling apart from within.
So what is Titty Pussy Butt doing with the Parthians? Aren't the Parthians the enemies of Rome?
Well, I guess he was mad because, you know, the Brutus and Cassius are defeated, and the only ones who are left are, you know, quote unquote, pro-Caesar, who fought against his father, and his father ended up killing himself at the Battle of Munda after he lost in 45 BC. So I guess he's just pissed at anybody who's on, you know, the Caesarian side and not from the Pompeian side. So he is just going to strike out, as far as I know, in any way he possibly could. And you have to admit, that's a pretty good start.
And who are the Parthians? Like, in our Alexander show, we know that this entire area was conquered by the Greeks and the Macedonians. So who are they at this stage of history?
Unfortunately, I can't answer that because they all wore hoods, and so I couldn't see their face. No, the Parthian Empire, I read some shit. I know they're big, badass guys, and you don't fuck with the Parthians, but please feel free to take it over from here.
You want to tag me? Tag me.
Tag.
I'm in. All right. Yeah. So, yes. So, for people who listen to our Alexander the Great show, you might wonder, well, who's running Persia at this stage? Iran, modern Iran. So, what happens is, kind of without wanting to spend too much time on this, it breaks down like this. So, Alexander, as we know, conquered all of Persia, so modern Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and then he went into Pakistan and a little bit of India, conquered it all, Egypt, Libya, Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. Didn't get too far down in there, but yeah, conquered that entire area. This is, you know, 334 to 323 BCE. After he dies, as we know, there is sort of a series of dust-ups. On his deathbed, they say, Alexander, who shall take over from me? And he goes, whichever one of you has the biggest swinging dick. And then he dies, and they're like, well, obviously he meant me. Like, look at this. Look, like it's like...
He was looking at me.
It's like a,
he was looking at
like
me.
A baby's arm holding a cricket ball down there, you know? So there's this, basically, the battle, the wars of the successors, or the wars of the Diadoque, as it's sometimes known as. Now, the Parthian Empire sort of, it's got nothing to do with that, except it's also known as the Arsacid Empire. Its name comes from Arses the First, big ass, as he was known by people. He's the number one ass. Arses the First of Parthia, who was a leader of the Parnai tribe, and there was a rebellion going on in sort of Iran's northeast, is a sort of a region of Parthia, in the mid-3rd century BCE, so sort of 247. They were in rebellion against the Seleucid Empire. Now, who was the Seleucid Empire? So this came out of the Wars of the Successors. There was a guy who's known in history as Seleucus the First Nicator, meaning victorious, who created the Seleucid Empire. Now, we haven't mentioned him at all in the Alexander series, I think, but he was an infantry general. He's been with Alexander since pretty much the get-go. He's been with him since 334, but he's sort of been a relatively minor player. The ancient sources barely even mention him until after Alexander's death. But he was an infantry general, quite high up, you know, towards the later stages of Alexander's career. When Alexander dies in 323, Seleucus initially supports Perdiccas, who sets himself up as the regent of Alexander's empire. But then you have the Wars of the Diadoque in 322. Perdiccas runs into trouble when he goes up against Ptolemy in Egypt. Ptolemy was another one of Alexander's leading generals. There was a mutiny of the troops. Perdiccas is assassinated by Seleucus, And a few other of his generals, sometime in 321, 320, somewhere like that. Eventually, you know, Seleucus partners with some other people. I think Antipater he gets behind for a while. But eventually he takes over control of Babylon, and that's the Seleucid Empire, which lasts until sort of the mid 3rd century CE. But the Parthian Empire broke away from that sort of 247, something like that. So, the Seleucid Empire probably broke down in the 1st century BCE. Sorry, I was looking at my Parthian dates. Yeah, the Seleucid Empire was, you know, conquered by the Romans by, I think, you know, Pompey kind of went in and took control of it around 63. This is when he appointed Archelaus and these sorts of guys in Palestine and Syria and took control of all those areas. So that's a quick history on the Parthians. Labienus, titty pussy bum. Now he,
Junior.
Yeah, he has partnered up with King Orodes of Parthia. This is a dude running the show at the moment. Now, when he was with Brutus and Cassius, Labienus, they sent him to King Orodes. Cassius had done battle with King Orodes before and ended up forming an alliance with him. They sent Labienus up there to get reinforcements before the Battle of Philippi. So Labienus the younger turns up and Orodes goes, "Hey, what's the hurry, kid? Let's just wait and see what happens." No need to rush in. Devils rush in where angels fear to tread. Haven't you read that? The world's only 6,000 years old. Haven't you heard? even Labienus said, "You're a fucking moron." But okay, let's hang around and wait and see what happens. Battle of Philippi obviously doesn't go well for Brutus and Cassius. And Labienus thinks it's probably not a good idea to return to Rome. So he sticks around with the barbarians. Like these are native Persian Parthians. So, you know, he goes native with them. And then when he finds out, oh, by the way, this king that he's palled up with, Orodes, guy whose army defeated Crassus back in 53 BCE at the Battle of Carrhae. Wow. And pours gold down Crassus's decapitated throat, or decapitated head, of his decapitated head. That's probably a better way of saying it. So this dude, like, he's still around. This is 10 years later, give or take.
You'll take
12
shit.
Years later. Yeah. Right. So same guy. So, you know, he goes way back. Hates the Romans. We hate the Romans. Anyway, now, when Labienus finds out that Antony's in Egypt banging Cleopatra and Octavian's up in Perugia fighting Lucius and they're being starved by sexy P, he says, you know what? Now's a good time, Orodes. Now's a good time to start to attack Rome's outer provinces. So it's actually a pretty smart idea when the Romans are fighting themselves and not paying attention. He swoops in, and it goes pretty easily too, because many of the troops stationed in the garrisons in these remote provinces were actually former soldiers of Brutus and Cassius. And they go, "Oh, titty pussy bum, where have you been, dude? Like, you disappeared. We thought you were dead." He goes, no, man, I'm hanging with the Persians, dude. And they're like, "Oh, the fucking Persians. Oh, good for you." How hot is Roxanne? Did you see her in that film?
And they're looking for leadership, basically. Yeah, they're looking for some guidance, some leadership, someone to take control and give him some objective what to do.
Yeah, so he conquers a lot of these places without even them putting up a struggle. But he has a couple of battles. He's taken over eventually Syria, all of Palestine, sets himself up as imperator. But I love this line from Dio. Dio writes, "As for Antony, although he kept himself informed of all of these operations, as no doubt he did in the case of what was going on in Italy also, for he was ignorant of none of them whatsoever, yet he failed in both instances to take defensive measures in time. Instead, he was so under the sway of his passion and of his drunkenness that he gave not a thought either to his allies or to his enemies."
Or a fig, a thought or a fig.
Yeah, he didn't give a fox, as we say now. So, Yeah, he's like, yeah. Oh, they're taking over Syria and Palestine. He can be fucked. I'm drunk. Beating up this young,
right,
half Greek pussy.
Half my age. Woo! Woo-hoo! Yeah.
Can't do that. Makes me cough now.
You know who else hit this? Caesar. I am going rolling. Caesar has been before. Woo!
Caesar's sloppy seconds. I'm not sure.
That's not a coffee mug worthy.
It is, actually. We should get one just with Cleopatra on it.
Just to see if the company would print it and go, Mr. Harris, we have a question about your order. So, yeah.
Sloppy seconds. yeah. So Antony's got a fleet, but only a small army. And he's got to be cautious because now this is going on. This could go really badly for Rome if the Parthians keep conquering more territory, getting bigger and bigger armies.
Yeah.
Well, Ray, I know it's kind of in a weird spot, but I think we need to end the episode here because we've run out of time and
we have
other things like the Cold War to go and prep for.
Exactly.
So that's the end of episode 17, leaving it up in the air a little bit, but, just we'll be back next week.
It will all come together with the next episode, I promise.
All right, so have a good week. Remember, hillsdale.edu/LOC. Remember, lifeofcaesar.com/Vegas. Remember, there's a Cold War series coming at the end of next month. And remember to tell your mum you love her.
Exactly. And not only that, but remember, at Hillsdale LOC, it's free.
Yeah.